So today I'm sitting here with Ellen Klages. Ellen, welcome to Galactic Chat.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So I was doing some research on you last night and I came across this that I wanted to ask you straight away.
Okay.
You smoked a joint with Lily Tomlin.
I did. Actually, it was a pipe. It was a friend's pipe. We were in college and we had gone into Detroit. I went to school at the University of Michigan. So we went into Detroit to see a Lily Tomlin concert, and my friend Nancy always had her bong with her. Always. This is 1975. And so she said, let's go backstage. And the concert was over. And I said, we can't. There's security guards. She said, come on. And we got backstage and we found Lily Tomlin. And we said, that was really wonderful. And she said, yeah, thanks. And Nancy said, do you want to smoke? And Lily Tomlin said, I'd like to, but my parents are here. and we said, really? And she said, okay, maybe one hit. So we smoked a bong with Lily Tomlin.
That's cool. So I know for a fact that you ended up at Clarion South, and I was wondering if you could tell us how that happened, and was it all right? Did the Australians break you?
The Australians did not break me. The reason I went to Clarion South was that I published my first short story when I was 44, and I knew about Clarion when I was in college, and I had read the three Clarion anthologies that Kate and Damon had put out, and I thought that sounded really cool, but when I was in college, I didn't really want to write science fiction. And then stuff happened and I really wasn't writing. I was writing for myself. I was writing when I was depressed. I was doing the things that people who want to be writers do when they're not really writers because they're not really writing. And I was working at the Exploratorium with Pat Murphy, who's a science fiction writer. And I published a story, Time Gypsy, which came out in 1994. I wrote it in 1995. I think it came out in 1998. So I was 44 years old when my first story came out. And I had one or two other stories. And I was kind of getting well-known, and I was starting to go to cons, and I knew people. And people were talking about Clarion, and people were talking about teaching at Clarion, and people were talking about going to Clarion. And I was thinking, I want to go to writer's camp. But I'm old, and people were saying, no, people go at any age. And by that point, I had, I think, a Campbell nomination, a Hugo nomination, and a Nebula nomination. And so I was talking to, and I knew most of the writers who were teaching in the United States at Clarion West and at Clarion. And I said, well, I really want to apply. And they said, well, no, you're in your mid-career. And it's like, well, but I want to go to writer's camp. And so Nalo Hopkinson went to the first year of Clarion South, which was in Brisbane in Australia. And she came back and she said, if you really want to go, apply to Clarion South because they're in their first year. The age of the participants is much, much older, and the range of experience is much vaster because you have people who have running their own small presses, and you have people who publish novels, and if you want to go, apply there. So I did. And everybody that I knew said, you're shooting your career in the foot. You can't go off to Clarion at this stage in your career. And I said, yes, I can. And I did. Apparently, the Clarion Selection Committee argued for about 3 weeks about whether or not they could accept me. But I said in my cover letter, look, I have probably more accomplishments than most of the people who apply, but I've never had any training as a writer. I've never gone off to school to do this. I have no discipline when I'm at home, and I really want to see what I can do if I'm doing nothing else for 6 weeks. And it was a fabulous experience. I ended up knowing three of the instructors very well and not knowing three of the instructors at all. It was Sean Williams the first week, who I didn't know, Michael Swanwick, who I knew very well, and who was an amazing teacher, Ellen Datlow the third week, who I've roomed with at almost every convention I've been at, including this one. And the fourth week was Margot Lanigan, who I'd never heard of, never met. I said, well, this new instructor that's coming in tomorrow, you know, what's she written? And somebody handed me the volume Black Juice. And so I just turned to the first story and read it, which was Singing My Sister Down, which is probably the best short story I've read in a decade. And I thought, what am I possibly going to write for that woman? And that was amazing because Margot and I just hit it off and we had the same sort of feel for language. And then the fifth week was Ian Irvine. And then the sixth week was Scott Westerfield, and and Justine Larbaleste was also there, and they're old friends of mine. So it was a very mixed bag, but culturally it was fascinating because American English and Australian English appear to be the same language and are not. I had one story that I had somebody get up for breakfast and make tea and put jelly on their toast. And everybody was going, no one would do that. It's like, it's breakfast, the jelly, toast. And they go, no one would ever do that. And I said, well, what do you put on toast? And they said, jam. And I said, well, the difference between jam and jelly is there's more pectin in jelly and there's more chunks of fruit in jam. And I finally, after about 20 minutes, figured out that in Australia, jelly means jello.
Yeah.
And no, in fact, in America, nobody does put jello on their toast. But it was stuff like that and just exploring, you know, a completely different country. It was the height of summer. I got there on December 30th. Actually, I got there on New Year's Eve. I left Cleveland, Ohio when it was 34 degrees, and I got to Brisbane and it was 34 Celsius. So it was high summer in the jungle. And I was there were three non-Australians in my clarion class. So it was this great cultural thing where I was learning not only about other people's stories, but about, you know, this other culture and other country, and people would take me to the mall and introduce me to Tam Tams and you know, so it was great. It was the best thing I think I ever did.
So, but now I have to ask, what did you write for Margot Lanigan?
I wrote the story Guy's Day Out for Margot Lanigan. It is, Michael Swanwick said the second week, you have to, I had turned in a story that I had kind of half written before I got to Clarion, and I finished it at Clarion, called Mobius, Stripped of a Muse, which is in Portable Childhoods, my short story collection. Mm-hmm. And Swanwick said, and it's about, I don't know, 1,200 words. And Swanwick said, this is just a piece of fluff. You just did this off the top of your head. And I said, I took me a couple of days to write that. And he said, your assignment is to write the hardest thing you can think of every time.
Yeah.
And so for Margot, I had this idea in the back of my head for a story. It's the fastest story I ever wrote. I wrote it in 36 hours with about 4 hours of sleep somewhere in the middle of that 36 hours, from start to finish. And it's possibly the most heartbreaking story I've ever written. And it's all language and imagery and really powerful emotional stuff without much of anything happening on the page. And Margot liked it. And Ellen Datlow eventually bought it for sci fiction, where it got very mixed reviews because some people really hated it and some people got it, which is fine. But that's what I wrote for Margot.
So I guess, what would be your writing style if 36 hours straight is the quickest you write? Do you sit down and write, or do you sit and think and come back and rework?
I procrastinate is my writing process. I'll get an idea for a story. Most of the short stories that I write for a particular editor or a particular volume. Somebody will say, oh, I'm doing a volume of which stories, in the case of the last story I just published. Would you like to do something for me? And I'll say, yeah. And when? And they go, oh, and now, yeah, like a year and a half from now. I say, okay, fine. And then a year later, he says, you know, 6 months from now. I go, okay. And I will have been thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been scribbling notes at times where I'll see something and I'll go and I'll have, I've started just having one notebook per story so that I can always find where my scribbles are. And I'll scribble and I'll scribble and I'll have ideas from all over the map and they're all cool and I don't know how they're going to come together. And then at some point I sit down and I write what I know of the story as a long kind of narrative poem. And it's just images and words. And the last couple of times I've done it, 95% of that makes it into the story. And I get out the images that are in my head without worrying about, because if I sit down and try to write prose, I get stuck in the, I have to have a topic sentence, and this has to be a full sentence. And if I just let myself, I do a sketchbook that's online, and I just do stream of consciousness until I get from the beginning to the end. And then I sit down with that and work through where the actual story beats need to be and go from there. The last story I worked on, I was traveling, and usually I don't write when I'm traveling because it's distracting, and I don't have the focus, but I had a deadline. And so I built in, on a month-long trip, I built in 3 days where I was in a hotel by myself where I knew no one, and I would just get up in the morning and sit on the couch and write all day for, at one point, 16 hours, 17 hours a day. And then I could edit in smaller bursts. But I write longhand.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a three-step process because I'll have these ideas and then I'll scribble a first draft in longhand and then I have to type it in. And then once it's on my laptop, then I'm editing mostly on the computer. But that first scribbly stage it's where my brain sort of does the creative dump and then, because if the editor brain takes over too early, I go, this is stupid. I can't do this. And what I really want is to get all of the nuggets that I know have to be in the story. And then I figure out what else needs to be there in order to make it a story and rather than a kind of bad poem.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the exciting thing is this weekend, your story From Witches was reprinted in The Guardian newspaper online, which I'll put a link to the show notes for this. Anybody can go and read it. And I sat last night and read it. While I was researching, I read that you said in a Locus interview that you like to write from the point of view of children. And our friend Jonathan Strahan says that you write with a reminiscent nostalgia for the 50s. So I wondered if you could perhaps sum up where you see yourself as a writer and what appeals to you about writing from the point of view of a child.
Let me contradict Jonathan. I don't feel like I write with a nostalgic point of view from the 50s. It's that if I have a character and the character in the witch story is Lizzie and she is 4, I go back to what little I can remember of my own 4-year-old self. I look at pictures of when I was 4. My Facebook picture at the moment is a picture of me at the age of 4 in a witch costume for Halloween. And I was 4 in 1958. So it's not so much that I'm nostalgic for the 50s, it's that that's my cultural reference. And when I'm trying to write, the reason I like to write from the point of view of children is, there's a couple of reasons. One of them is it's a much simpler worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of cases in the story Basement Magic, it takes place entirely in a house because the kid in that one is 6 and that's all she knows. She doesn't go out into the world by herself because she's too young. And I remember when I was a kid, I knew every inch of my backyard and every inch of my friends' backyards. And you know your very small world in a way of detail that you will never again know anything in your life, unless you're in prison or something, and you probably know every detail of yourself. But kids have a very limited world that is incredibly rich in detail. And there is both an innocence and a way of presenting the world to a reader where you don't have to explain as much, and you get to leave complicated bits like politics and plumbing and insurance out because kids don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And kids believe in magic and dragons and witches in a way that adults don't. And I find that kind of refreshing. I started writing about kids just because most of my, if you're writing when you're 22, you don't have a lot of life experience. And what's behind you is childhood. And I find childhood to be a very interesting intersection of complete innocence and the idea that everything in the world is dangerous. Because everything under the sink could kill you. You can't cross the street without somebody else because it could kill you. You can't, play with scissors or don't open anything in that drawer. Don't touch that. Don't. And mostly nothing happens. But there is this constant edge of danger in childhood that I find appealing along with the innocence. Because if it's just innocent, it's really sweet, and I don't do sweet.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the settings, I mostly set things in the past just because I was a child in the past and I'm drawing on my own memories. And if I'm trying to think of, you know, what would a kid watch on TV? I don't know what a four-year-old would watch on TV now. They'd pop in a video and they'd watch Barney over and over and over again, or whatever the Barney equivalent is of 2012. But I want it to be my childhood. And then I can write from the inside out rather than from the outside looking in.
So for the collection Witches, Lizzie is not supposed to like or relate to the witch.
No.
In Sleeping Beauty.
Sleeping Beauty.
And in fact is discouraged actively by the adults around her. No, you can't like the ugly witch. And she actually, her heart breaks when they're mean to the witch. I was tempted to read multiple layers into what you were saying in that piece.
Good. I would hope you would read multiple layers in. I mean, some of it is possibly the most autobiographical story I've ever written. There's very little in that story that didn't actually happen. But I saw Sleeping Beauty, and the princess was pink and wussy. And I was not a pink wussy girl. I was a sturdy little tomboy girl. And so the witch had power. The witch could turn into a dragon, and she had her own castle. And really, there's no bad to that when you're a kid. Having your own house and nobody can tell you what to do. And so I was like Cruella de Vil, kind of the same way. I mean, I grew up on Disney. Being an American kid from the 50s, and the witches were the strongest things in those movies. Disney is finally 50 years later starting to make princesses that have a little bit of spunk, but the only person in a Disney movie that had spunk was the witch. And yes, my mother did try to explain, it's like, no, but we don't like her, we like the fairies. And it's like, no, I like the witch. The father, and Maleficent, if you look at Maleficent, she's a stunningly beautiful witch. And there's a line in the story where the kid says, she's beautiful. And the father says, no, honey, she's the witch. As if those two things cannot exist at the same time. But I watched Sleeping Beauty. I took notes. And then I was looking at all these pictures of Maleficent and going, yeah, I understand. Cause I remember having a Maleficent puppet. I didn't really remember it much of anything else because I was four. So I'm going back and looking at pictures of myself as a four-year-old and then watching Sleeping Beauty again as an adult and taking notes and then trying to get into the mindset of somebody whose experience is, you know, it's her first movie. She's never seen a movie before. She takes it literally. The witch is real because she's four and the witch is real. I don't know if the witch is real for the reader. I mean, I hope that story could be read in two ways. You can read it as a completely mainstream story about a suburban girl in, you know, I don't even think I specify the city that it's in, but somewhere in America in the 50s. And as completely mainstream, and you can also read it as a fantastic story. And I think you can read it as both at the same time. There are a couple of lines. There's one line where Lizzie is watching the movie and her eyes get really big. And the line is, Lizzie is enchanted. Now in a mainstream story, Lizzie's enchanted by the movie. In a genre story, Lizzie is enchanted. And there's two or three lines in there that I was deliberately playing with the idea of fairy tales and how fairy tales when you're a kid and real life kind of have the same weight because your definition of what is possible hasn't been narrowed down in the way that it is as an adult. And yeah, the adults are saying, well, no, that's the witch. And she's like, but look at her, you know. She's cool.
My heart broke for her in that moment, actually. And in some ways leads on to my next question, which is that you're on the motherboard for the Tiptree. And I wanted to ask you how that came about and what your role is.
Being on the motherboard of the James Tiptree Jr. Literary Award is an award given every year for the work of science fiction or fantasy that best explores or expands gender roles. And it was made up by Pat Murphy and Karen Fowler, when Pat was the guest of honor at WISCON in 1992 or 93, I don't really remember. And Pat was the guest of honor. She gave a guest of honor speech, and she said, and we have decided to, that there's no science fiction award named after a woman, and so we would like to found the James Tiptree Award. And the people who are in on the joke and know that James Tiptree was a pseudonym for Alice Sheldon, who was a woman, got it, and everybody else is going, what? And it was kind of sort of a joke as far as Pat and Karen were concerned. I mean, and immediately the people at WISCON said, we will have bake sales, we will fund this, we will make a quilt. And it took off. And unlike, I mean, it's really kind of unusual in that it started out from the get-go with lots and lots and lots of support from the feminist community and the science fiction community. It's now been going on for 23 years. And it is one of the few awards in science fiction, or was at the time, that actually pays the winner. We give the winner $1,000, a piece of art commissioned about them or their work, a tiara. They don't get to keep the tiara, but they get to wear it for the weekend. Some chocolate. So it's a really cool award. And in 1994, I was at ReaderCon, and it was the second or third Tiptree Award. And the winner that year was Nicola Griffith for Ammonite. And the guest of honor at ReaderCon was Ursula Le Guin. And it was my 40th birthday. And so I said to Pat, I'm having a birthday party. And she said, oh, I'll be at ReaderCon. And I live in San Francisco. And I said to some other friends, I'm having a birthday party. And they said, oh, we'll be at ReaderCon. So I went to ReaderCon because all my friends were going to be there. And it was my birthday. And somebody on the committee came up to Pat and said, we've got some donations that people wanted to do for the Tiptree. And we thought we'd auction them off after the awards ceremony. Do you want to do it? And she said, no, but I've got a friend here who will do anything. She'll do it. And so I'd been taking a nap, and I woke up from my nap, and I found Pat, and I probably in the bar, and she said, oh, they're going to auction off some stuff after this. Do you want to do it? And I said, yeah, sure. So very long ceremony, and then they interviewed Ursula, and there's all this stuff. And then there were, as I remember, like 10 fairly random objects. There were like 4 hardback books, none of which I'd ever heard of or heard of their authors, because I was not part of science fiction at that point. And a couple of t-shirts, and I don't remember what else. And 45 minutes later, we had $1,000.
Wow.
Because I was on that night. I was on that night like I don't think I've ever been on. I was just, the audience was laughing. And so I did this auction. And then the next year, I went to WISCON. And they said, well, do you want to do an auction again? So I did an auction at like, I don't know, 3 in the afternoon on a Friday. We sold some stuff. We raised some money. And then the next year or the year after, the auction was on Monday morning. And lots of people were leaving for the airport, and on a Monday morning, no one has been to the bar yet. And their wallets are not as loose as they are. And so I thought, okay, I have to do something because this is just, it is as most fundraising auctions are really kind of boring.
Mm.
So I said, I'm going to pass the hat. And if it comes back with $500 in it, you can shave my head on stage. And everybody went, and some people were going, no, honey, don't do that. It's like, no, I've always kind of wanted to shave my head. And so we passed the hat. It came back with $500. Somebody went down to their car and got clippers. Somebody else took the skirt off of the table in front of the room in the hotel and wrapped it around me, and we shaved my head. The next year, we had twice as many people come to the auction because people were going, no, really, you never know what this woman's going to do. And now the auction is at WISCON on Saturday night. It is a 3-hour, one-woman show, and we generally raise between $7,000 and $9,000 a year to fund the Tiptree because everybody is very generous and because it's bread and circuses. So I did a couple of auctions for maybe 2 or 3 years, and then they asked me to be on the motherboard as pretty much the fundraising arm. And we have other fundraisers. There are bake sales. There are bake sales all over the world. But our primary fundraiser is the Tiptree Auction. And if you Google Tiptree Auction, you will find many, many things, including a picture of me in a chicken suit.
I'm going to leave that as a mystery. That's a significant role. I haven't asked you about your novels, but I wonder if you could tell us a bit about them.
Well, my first novel is The Green Glass Sea, and it came out of a short story that I was trying to write for a writing group that I was in 2001. And every month we would meet and we would give each other writing prompts and challenges. And the challenge that month was to write a robot story. For any of you who have read my novel, you're going, what? So robot story. So I'm in the bookstore and I just come back from a vacation in New Mexico. And I wanted to set a story in New Mexico because then I could write the vacation off. And I was looking at a map of New Mexico and trying to find a city to set a robot story in. And I saw the name Alamogordo, and like all the hair on my body went up in that way that you do when you're really scared. And I thought, why am I scared of the map? Why am I scared of that name? And I couldn't remember what Alamogordo was other than it was a scary word. And so I went to look it up, and it was the place where the first atomic bomb test was in the New Mexico desert in 1945. And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool if there had been an atomic bomb test in New Mexico the same weekend that the aliens came to Roswell in 1947, knowing no history at all. And so I went looking. And in fact, there was only one test in New Mexico, and it was in 1945. The rest of them were in Nevada or in water. But as I was looking, I found a sentence that said, many of the scientists on the Manhattan Project took their children down to the Trinity site for a picnic to show them what Daddy had been working on. And as a science fiction writer, I'm going, oh, there's a bad idea. Let's go have a picnic on an atomic bomb site. And mostly they were doing this like 2 to 3 to 4 weeks after the test. So I wrote this short story called The Green Glass Sea, after about 4 or 5 months of research, about this family that takes their two girls down to this test site to see what Daddy had been working on. And the thing that got me started, and the reason it's called The Green Glass Sea, is that there was a sentence that said, the heat of the test bomb was so intense that it melted 75 acres of desert into glass. And I thought, wow, I have never heard of that before. And I went off to look for the Big Book of Atomic Glass to find out more. And there wasn't any more. That was it. Every book I found on the Trinity test or that mentioned the Trinity test had like one sentence about the glass, because it wasn't scientifically interesting. It was a side effect. It melted the desert into glass. But that's what happens when sand gets really hot. It turns into glass. So I got more and more and more and more and more interested in finding out about this glass, until the point where I thought, if I could paint, I would paint a picture of this 75 acres. The 75 acres is a circle that is approximately 8 football fields across. It's of glass. And I ran a description of a pilot that had flown over. And this is in the middle of as much nowhere as America has. So everything is just brown. And he was flying over, and all of a sudden there's this giant green, what he thought was a lake. He said it would look like a lake of green glass or a sea of green glass. So I wrote this short story about these kids who go down to see the glass. And I sent it off to Gardner Dozois at Asimov's, and he sent me back the nicest rejection letter I will ever receive that said, this is a wonderful story. I can't buy it because it isn't science fiction. Because it happened. And I was thinking, but it's fiction about science. And I sent it off to a couple of other places, and nobody would buy the story because it wasn't science fiction. So I put it in a drawer. I think I read it aloud at a WISCON, and I looked up, and everybody in the room was like, and I thought, oh, it's a horror story. I don't know why I hadn't noticed that. I must be, like, psychotic if I didn't think that putting children in this kind of danger is horrible. But that hadn't occurred to me before. Because it was the adventure of it. So I put it in a drawer, but people were coming up to me for like 5 years after that going, the atomic story, where did that ever come out? I go, it didn't. Because I couldn't sell it. And I finally sold it to Strange Horizons, who published it as The Green Glass Sea, and I think it's still in their archives. And then maybe a year later, I don't think it was published at this time, I read a story at WISCON that had a kid in it. And Sharon November, who was an editor at Viking, came up and said, "You write children's books." And I said, "I do not. I write stories with children in them. It's not the same thing." And she said, "Well, I'm an editor at Viking and I edit children's books. And if you ever want to do a children's book, let me know." And so I went home and I thought, an editor in New York would like to see a novel. I don't write novels. I write short stories. On the other hand, an editor in New York would like to see a novel. So children's book. Children's book. Puppies. Elves. And I was so bored with everything that I was coming up with. And I thought, well, okay, I don't write for children. I write about children. I don't write for children. And then I thought, oh, the atomic story. So I sent Sharon the short story, The Green Glass Sea. And then I woke up the next morning and thought, oh, great. Well, so much for having a career in publishing, because that's going to... And she wrote back and she said, that would be interesting, as much as you can have a tone of voice in email. You know, let me see 90 pages in an outline. And the outline of The Green Glass Sea ends with Dewey, with the Roswell aliens coming down in 1947 and taking Dewey back to their home planet, which kind of isn't in the book anymore. Because I gave the outline to Sharon and I gave her the first 90 pages and she said, yeah, I really like this. You know, this, the ending, how wedded are you to the ending? And it's like, yeah, I can't figure out a way not to make it hokey because the rest of it was getting very realistic and very historical fiction. So we cut the aliens. And eventually Sharon bought the book and it came out and it won the Scott O'Dell Award for historical fiction for 2006. And won the New Mexico Book Award. And then I wrote a sequel that won the California Book Award and the New Mexico Book Award. And Green Glass Sea is now, Viking's got a program called Classroom Classics. And so it's now being taught in classrooms. And it's because it covers math and science and history and language arts. And but the idea, I mean, it's been out for 6 years, but the idea that I wrote a classic just tickles me. So I've got these two novels that are related. They're Green Glass Sea, and then the sequel is White Sand, Red Menace. But it came out of trying to write a short science fiction short story about a robot. Yeah, you never know where your fiction's going to go.
I would expect nothing less. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ellen.
Thank you.